I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to discuss the Dig Indy Tunnel Project, the $2 billion project to divert sewer overflow from Indy waterways is underway and led by Citizens Energy. My guests will be Laura O'Brien from Citizens Energy, John Tripas, Director of Underground Engineering and Construction, and Nick Maynard, Construction Specialist. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about the big Dig Indy Tunnel project today on No Limits. If you want to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Laura O'Brien of Citizens Energy, John Tripas, Director of Underground Engineering and Construction, and Nick Maynard, Construction Specialist. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. So let's talk about this. I mean, I think before people can really get into this, they need to know what the project is and understand that it is more than a notion. It's not something that we as a community or Citizens Energy could do on a whim. So how about if we start with you on that, Laura, but I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts about some of the challenges and what the scope of the project is going to be.
Yeah, well, this is an incredibly complicated project. And actually, John can share about how it started, why we're doing it in the first place, where we are, and how it's going.
Okay. I guess that's your cue then, John.
All right. Sounds great. So like a lot of cities, Indianapolis has an antiquated combined sewer overflow system. Combined sewers, if you're not familiar with them, it's basically we mix the wastewater from homes and businesses with the stormwater on the streets. It's fairly common practice in the late 1800s. So there's about 800 communities, primarily in the Midwest and Northeast United States, that have combined sewer systems, including the nation's capital, Chicago, Cincinnati, a lot of our peer cities. And really what we've been mandated to do since the 1990s, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency basically indicated they wanted to reduce and try to eliminate combined sewer overflows into the waterways. So because we mix the stormwater and the wastewater in the system, when there's heavy rain events, sometimes exceeding just a quarter of an inch of rain, it'll activate over 130 combined sewer outfalls in the city of Indianapolis, and that affects every river water body we have. So the White River, Fall Creek, Pleasant Run, Pogues Run, Eagle Creek will all get discharges, and those discharges of really raw sewage mixed with stormwater is upwards of 6 billion gallons per year. And to kind of put that into context, it takes three Lucas Oil stadiums. If you filled those up with raw wastewater, again, that's a scary proposition, but that's
and not
about
a particularly appealing image, but that's a whole
not appealing, but that's about a billion gallons. So, you know, every year we have upwards of 30 Lucas Oil stadiums discharging into our waterways. So it's a huge impact on water pollution. And the big goal of the Dig Indy program was to comply with the federal consent order. And we've spent years doing the studies to try to get the most economical package for the city of Indianapolis. And part of that's really the Dig Indy program and deep tunnel system.
Nick, what are some of the challenges associated with doing this? I mean, we've already mentioned one. We've got a system that dates back to the 1800s, right?
Yeah, I guess the biggest impact is just to residents around where we're constructing some of this infrastructure. So primarily right now we're working on Meridian and 28th Street. So you definitely have seen that when you've traveled to and from downtown.
And in terms of the challenges of doing something like this, and we should point out, it's not an insignificant, I mean, we're talking about a $2 billion project, correct, Laura?
Yes, that's correct.
So, you know, in terms of doing this, what are some of the logistical challenges? John's signaling he's the guy to take that one.
Yes. Yeah, so the backbone of the program, like other cities, there are certain things you can do. One wants to maybe separate our sewer system. So like the newer surrounding communities outside of Indianapolis, they have a separate storm sewer system and a separate sanitary system, which is fairly cost effective when you're building new communities and additions to the city. However, because the downtown core area was already built in Indianapolis, again, what a lot of cities have done, again, including Chicago, Cincinnati's looking at it, and St. Louis, is a deep tunnel system, which is really the backbone of the program. So as part of that, what we did, we started in the late 1990s and early 2000s to basically start evaluating how could we build a tunnel system in Indianapolis. And we took borings in the ground upwards of 300 feet deep. And we decided after there's about 100 feet of upper soils in Marion County in Indianapolis. And then we get into limestone bedrock. And you see a lot of limestone around downtown Indianapolis. A lot of the monuments are made of limestone, portions of the state house. And the tunnel is actually, on average, about 250 feet below ground, deep over 100 feet into the limestone. And part of that is, for engineering reasons, it's a safe environment to build a tunnel, and it was a very cost-effective environment to help build this tunnel as well. And this tunnel system that will extend about 28 miles will store over 250 million gallons of this combined sewage overflow, which is relevant. So each storm event, which there's about 60 to 70 per year that we'll capture in the tunnel, will store this and prevent upwards of 97-99% of that CSO from going into the water bodies. So it'll really help to clean up the river. So when we look at the technical component of it, Nick mentioned some of the surface work. So an interesting piece to what we're doing. So we're mining this tunnel right now. We're currently under a portion of the White River. It's a 20-foot diameter tunnel inside the bedrock. And we line that with concrete once we mine through it. And then really the impact to the surface, really to the streets, is trying to get the flow, these 130-some-odd CSOs that are in the rivers, is getting those to consolidate and then drop them down into the tunnel at strategic areas around the city with the goal of trying to limit the impacts to the extent we can. And Nick could talk about this a little bit. I know he mentioned Meridian and 28th Street and some of our other closures. We literally have to close the entire roadway, and a lot of times these existing combined sewer overflow pipes, they could be upwards of 8-10 foot in diameter, and sometimes they're right in the middle of the road, so we don't have a lot of opportunities with other utilities in the area other than to close the roadway.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Dig Indy Tunnel Project and the ways in which it is going to affect and transform both Indianapolis and central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Nick, among other things, I'm just curious, how do you get people to work 250 feet below below the surface of the earth? I mean, that's fascinating, especially since, you know, most of us were transfixed by the difficulties of getting people out of, caves and tunnels around the world. How do you do that, and how do you make sure that they're safe?
Yeah, I guess, well, that job isn't for everyone. I guess I'll start with saying that. Some people like going down there. Some people don't. But we've hired a couple very good contractors to work down in the tunnel. They've got some really good laborers and some really good operators to be down in there.
We've gotten actually an email from a listener named Casey. And again, if you want to join this conversation by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Casey writes, I have a question for Nick Maynard. Where will the deep tunnel system store raw waste until the water treatment plant can process it?
That's a very good question, Casey. So I'll tag on to what John said earlier, is really this tunnel system is essentially a large storage tunnel. So once the rain event will end, we will then pump out the tunnel and take it to our treatment plant, which is the Southport treatment plant down the south side of Indianapolis. We'll treat that water and then discharge the clean water into White River.
How does that treatment process work? I mean, what things do you do to that raw sewage to make it clean?
So we have an advanced treatment process. Basically, it's a series. We just expanded and we doubled that plant, anticipating the flows that we would get from the tunnel system. But it's through a series of screening. So initially, flows going to the plant, we try to screen out some of the heavier debris and grit. And then we do what's called primary treatment, which is, for lack of a better word, they're settling basins. So we settle out a lot of the heavier solids will settle out in these large tanks. And then once it completes that process, it'll run through a biological process where we'll actually aerate the wastewater and we'll encourage the growth of microbugs to kind of eat some of the nitrogen-based material inside the wastewater. Then we'll do a final settling, and then we'll actually run that through an ultraviolet filtration unit. So the ultraviolet will help to kill a lot of the bacteria, and then we'll dose it with a little bit of chlorine, and then we'll remove that chlorine before discharging it in the river. So it's pretty standard for the Midwest treatment-wise. We get a high removal rate and fairly clean water that goes right back into the river.
Laura, Citizens Energy is spearheading this. What are some of the challenges for citizens in dealing with this?
Well, I think, like Nick said, some of the challenges are inconveniences to residents here in the area. And we strive with everything we do to make it as, not impactful as possible on those residents. I think part of the really important message is that, you know, this is really going to transform our waterways. This is going to change the way Indianapolis can use our waterways. So we know it's painful. We feel those, you know, we feel those pains ourselves when we can't go straight down Meridian Street to get to work. But I think it's important to let people know what kind of impact this is going to have on our waterways. And so just getting the word out about that. And, you know, like we've said, it's happening 250 feet underground for the most part, aside from the surface work. And so a lot of people they can't grasp what's going on, don't understand what the purpose of the tunnel is. So really getting out there and talking with the residents in Indianapolis, letting them know what we're doing, why we're doing it, I think is really important.
We know this is a big, big project. I'm going to stay with you on this one, Laura, but if anyone wants to chime in, feel free. You know, $2 billion is a lot of money and all of that. How long is it going to take to complete this? Because I can't imagine that it's going to be easy to move things quickly when you are working 250 feet below the surface
of
the earth.
It's not a short process. We began in 2011. Is that correct?
With the actual construction.
We began
work.
In 2011. At the end of December, we actually opened the first 10 miles of the tunnel. So that segment is now functional, and it will remove up to 1 billion gallons of sewage from our waterways per year. It'll keep it from entering. So that's already in place. However, the construction of the rest of the tunnel is going to take until 2025. That's our target to complete the tunnel. So you can see it's a long project. It's not something you just jump down there and bore through the rock and, oh, look, we're done. You know, it takes a while, but the benefits are going to be amazing.
And, John, what are some of the challenges that have popped up unanticipated? Because I would think going below the surface of the earth, there's going to be some stuff you just didn't see or couldn't predict until you get down there.
Yeah, no, absolutely, John. It's a good comment, and it's fairly technical, but loosely, I mean, we're about back in the ice ages when there was an ocean over Indiana, and about 350 million years ago is the rock strata that we're in right now. So as you can imagine, it's hard to know what happened a couple hundred years ago, let alone 350 million years. We do encounter probably the biggest thing we've been encountering in the limestone bedrock. Again, it's a very good media. We've collected well over 300 deep rock borings all along the alignment to try to profile what we're getting into, anticipate production rates, and help our contractor to gear up for the project. I'd say our biggest challenge is encountering groundwater. So there's interconnecting groundwater from the surface soil into the bedrock. And occasionally we'll hit joint sets or small openings in the limestone that sometimes have a higher level of groundwater than we anticipate.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the big Dig Indy Tunnel project. It's a $2 billion project that's going to divert sewer overflow from Indy waterways. It's underway and it's being led by Citizens Energy. My guests are Laura O'Brien from Citizens Energy, John Tripas, who is the Director of Underground Engineering and Construction, and Nick Maynard, Construction Specialist. If you want to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I do hope you will join the conversation. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the big Dig Indy Tunnel project. This $2 billion project to divert sewer overflow from Indy waterways is underway, and it's being led by Citizens Energy. My guests are Laura O'Brien from Citizens Energy, John Tripas, Director of Underground Engineering and Construction, and Nick Maynard, Construction Specialist. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Kevin has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. You're on the air. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I'd first like to thank all the public servants and the people at Citizens for getting this project put together and kicked off. What a wonderful thing for the city, and much gratitude from all of us.
Thank you.
Kevin.
Certainly.
South
thank
side,
you.
I've recognized that on the north side of the city, they've been able to enjoy the White River for years, for boating, getting out there, tubing, doing things like that. Do we expect that south of downtown, the White River will soon be as enjoyable?
Thanks very much for the call and the question. I'll see if we can get an answer for you.
Yes, Kevin, thank you. That's a very good question, and that's really why we're doing this. With the removal, we're literally going to remove, you know, there's 6 billion gallons of sewage to, on an average year, we'll still have an occasional overflow, and that'll be during some of the worst storm events where we anticipate within water quality guidelines, working with the EPA and our partners at Indiana Department of Environmental Management. There'll be a couple times during the year where we will be discharging, but for the most part, there'll be a marked improvement. We anticipate the improvement in fishable, swimmable activities in the water, wildlife in the water, whole ancillary activities that the water quality will get back to where it was well before CSOs were introduced.
Let me follow up on that, because we've done shows on the White River before, and even I think Kevin's point when he said that people up north have been able to use it, but I know in some cases that even folks who are in the city and the Broad Ripple area and all of that, the water quality in White River is not considered safe. So will this alter that, and how quickly? Because obviously it was more than a day or a week that went into contaminating this river. Undoing the damage is likely to take some time. How long do we anticipate that might be? Is it possible even?
We believe it's possible, and we'll notice marked improvements. So Laura mentioned we already have the first section of tunnel online, and really it starts from the south moving to the north. And again, the reason, as Nick mentioned, all the flows go to our Southport treatment plant on the south side of the city. So we kind of build up our tunnel, obviously, to get the flows as we work our way up north. And the next section will open will be what's called the White River and Lower Polk section, and that'll remove upwards of another 2 billion gallons per year in that section. When it's all complete, with the final Fall Creek and Pleasant Run sections that go online by 2025, we do expect a marked increase in water quality. We work with our water quality models. We've developed a model and we work with our partners at the city. They're also party to our consent decree on this project with the storm system. So there's still a separate storm system outside of kind of the downtown area's combined system. And they are actively working on their MS4 program for stormwater to help reduce some of those pollution impacts as well. So in my opinion, it'll be markedly improved. And I think most people that enjoy the waterways will know that.
Laura, is this the primary benefit as far as you and Citizens Energy see it, is that the improved quality of the waterways, or are there other benefits that are going to accrue to this community as a result of this work?
Well, I think the improved quality of the waterways will lead to other exciting things for neighborhoods, for economic development, for recreation. So it's not just that the waterways will be cleaner, but it's that we'll be able to engage with them in a new way. You know, it opens the door for more economic development. And really, you know, positions Indianapolis in a very unique spot, having this, you know, amazing waterway running right here through the city.
Gotten an email from a listener named Reed. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Reed writes, I appreciate that you're using local contractors for the work on the Dig Indy project. Have you considered leveraging the expertise of Elon Musk's company, The Boring Company? As a startup, they're desperate for exposure, and this could be a good enticement to get their assistance. No one is making eye contact right now.
John. Interesting fact on Elon Musk's is tunneling company. He actually is using one of our old tunnel boring machines from Indianapolis, so he might be reaching out for us for expertise.
The other way. Go ahead, John. Yeah,
I'll add to Nick. So we looked at a lot of different options. I mean, we solicited this project, and at Citizens, we have a real diverse supply chain group that helped us consider a lot of options, and one of those was category management and how to best leverage our contracting ability both locally, nationally, and globally to consider where we can get the best savings for the ratepayers. And for the deep tunnel mining portion of the project, it's a joint venture between J.F. Shea and Kiewit. Both of those companies are large global companies. They're based out of California, but they have a lot of experience, both over probably 50 to 100 years of experience, mining tunnels and a lot of work in heavy civil engineering type projects. So we were able to work with them and leverage the program and realize significant savings. They are actually on a contract for the entire tunneling portion of the program. It is set up in phases, so they completed the first phase of the project, and they were selected for the remaining segments of the tunnel. As we complete segments and get them online, we do hold an option just to be, I guess, realistic and conservative to make sure that they're doing a good job. We're still getting the pricing and the quality of work we desire. And so they're basically set to do the last two sections of Fall Creek and Pleasant Run, pending the good performance, which has been exemplary so far.
I can't imagine there are that many companies in the world with the expertise to do this, because it's not like this is an easy startup. You've got to invest in some pretty sophisticated equipment and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, how many people were there that you could take bids from even on this?
So our first phase of that was for the Deep Rock Tunnel section. Again, as Laura mentioned, is the first one online, the first 10-mile section. We had 9 interested bidders. Most of them, because of the value of that project, which is around $200 million just for that first section. Of the 9 companies, most of them were joint ventures just to be able to go and pursue the job. And you're right, the equipment is amazingly technical. Over the years, through a lot of developments, both in the U.S. and primarily in Europe and Asia, highly sophisticated laser computer-guided equipment. And the tunnel boring machine itself is about a $20 million machine that's about 400 feet long. So it's pretty substantial equipment and highly technical.
Got an email on that point from Ryan. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Ryan writes, what is the actual name for the machinery that creates the tunnels? I had a friend who used to refer to the equipment as the ostrich.
That's a good question. That's kind of funny. So the equipment, it's, I mean, the technical term would be globally, there's different types of machines, but they're called tunnel boring machines, or TBM for short. Regarding the naming, there's a lot of superstition in the industry. So there's many tunnels built. Well, they will name their TBM a particular name depending on what they're doing. However, there's a lot of superstition out there that if you might cause more harm to your project by naming your machine. We did a lot of consensus building throughout our organization and prior to when the city had the sewer system, and decided would be a little on the superstitious conservative side and not name our machine. So we do not have a name for our tunnel boring machine.
Nick, you're looking like you want to weigh in on that one.
I don't know what the ostrich is.
Okay, we've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Jonathan, and again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Jonathan writes, "How does will the Big Dig impact flooding along the residences of the White River? It would seem with all of the sequestered water that the Big Dig provides, the system would be available to minimize some of the flooding to the homes and neighborhoods such as Rocky Ripple, Ravenswood, and the South Side as well. Any comments?" Who wants that one? Is that everybody's looking your way again, John? Okay.
I'll take that one, and that's a real challenging question and a good question. To some extent, we are capturing some of those combined flows that would go into a water body. However, in Indiana, like a lot of the Midwest, it's, for lack of a better word, it's a flat state, and we have a tremendous amount of impervious area, concrete, streets that can really divert rainwater and stormwater into the river at a really high rate. Really, the levee system in Indianapolis, which is managed by the City of Indianapolis Department of Public Works, is what protects most of the flooding downtown. Expanding sections of that, like they have considered to the Rocky Ripple area and other areas, are really the best protection for our river systems. The tunnel system would, in major storm events, do very little to help protect from the flooding scenario we experience sometimes.
We're talking about the Big Dig here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Larry has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Larry, you're on the air.
John, I've heard this conversation before, but, you know, when they were installing our sewer systems for this city back in the late 1800s, I found an article out of a Collier's Cyclopedia that explained separate and combined sewage systems, right? The combined sewer system is based on the flow of water and the formula for it, and how the water flows is it's flushed out when you have a rain or a storm or something. If they sequester this water underground, they're creating another problem. What they're doing is sending it down into our aquifers, near our aquifers, and eventually it's going to leach into our aquifer water and have a whole new problem started. So I think that when you have a situation like this where you cannot correct it, you have to rebuild your sewers and get them and so that they flow correctly. Because if you ever been downtown on a hot night when there's not been much rain, you smell the problem. And I think that's going to be more and more backup down there because of the dense population that they're building in downtown. And these sewers are not going to be able to get flushed on a regular basis. So I think that's the problem. And I think that by digging these tunnels down so deep near our aquifers that can supply us fresh water in time of drought, you know, I think that they're ruining our groundwater also. So I just think their engineers may have made some miscalculation because you're talking about saving money. But there's no way you can calculate how much water is going to be coming. In fact, what they're doing all over the city is relining sewers. And when they reline a sewer, that takes away from the volume of water that it can actually happen. And that's why you're getting all the streets flooding and so forth. And one of their people said that it's because of global warming. Now, if you have to play it off on global warming, then that means you don't know what you're doing. So I think it's just dangerous. We should have stuck the project and redone our sewers like we were supposed to do, and have the new treatment plant that we already paid for in our water and sewer bills over the years. So I think this is a effort that has been untested. using untested materials. We don't know what the expectancy of these materials are, and we just need to rethink it.
Okay, Larry, thanks very much for the call. I'm going to see if I can get some answers for you. Thank you again for the call.
Hey, Larry. Yes. You had about three questions in there, and I'll try to give you some answers to those. And those are really thoughtful questions and concerns, by the way. And I appreciate the fact a lot of people don't look into reading about our older sewer system and how it was developed and why. So you're absolutely correct. With our combined system, they're literally designed to handle stormwater flows, sometimes up to a large 10-year event. Like most stormwater systems, the combined sewers are the same way, and they just added in the wastewater flow as the city was developing, really to limit flooding in the streets in the late 1800s. That was the first mechanism. That would be discharged directly into the waterways. But what happened after that is we built what's called an interceptor system. So the interceptors, they intercepted all of these combined sewers discharging into the waterways. And those interceptors are what took it in the early 1900s basically to these wastewater treatment plants and ultimately advanced wastewater treatment plants. So one of your questions is, when we discharge a flow into the tunnel, you know, will it impact our aquifers? Where the city does get 10 to 15% of its water supply, that's 10 to 15% from aquifers. The remainder is from surface water. But we have analyzed that, and we are 100% confident we will not impact our aquifer supply. So everything we work on is lined. It's fully lined with concrete. And how we design them with grout, they're basically impermeable, where they wouldn't exfiltrate from the tunnel storage system into the aquifer. And kind of the other component of that, without getting too technical, because there's so much, the groundwater table sits so high in Indianapolis, around 20 to 30 feet below the city, there's really a constant flow, or there's infiltrating water into our tunnel system. So I mentioned a little earlier in the conversation about infiltrating groundwater being a big problem for us. And that's what we're dealing with. There's always more groundwater, aquifer water, trying to push into the tunnel that we're trying to keep out. We have all closure gates on the tunnel system. So when we reach capacity in the tunnel, we will close those gates to make sure no additional flow comes in. So we would limit any potential of impacting or having that wastewater go into the aquifer.
Is there a danger? I mean, do you worry at all that, you know, in some ways, obviously, the system we had that dates back to the 1800s is a product of the best engineering and technology available at that time. Events overran it. Are there any safeguards in place to see that we're not building something that also is going to become obsolete fairly quickly? Or is it possible to do that even?
Yeah, I think it is possible, John. I mean, like anything else in society, I mean, the automobile at one time was a very unsafe vehicle, very unsophisticated to what we have now. And the same thing's occurring with engineering. I mean, the products we use, how we place them, and the contractors that do them, it's highly reliable. We look at our systems for over 100-year life. And kind of to go back, I guess, to answer part of your question, too, is we did look at, as part of what's called a long-term control plan, and we spent almost a decade evaluating alternatives and impacts on the community. If we were to replace every sewer in the city and separate those sewers, it was going to be well over $6 billion, between $6 to $8 billion, and numerous impacts to businesses and residents. This is literally every street downtown has a sewer in it. So we tried to evaluate, you know, what our best potential was, and we spend $10 to $15 million per year right now relining sewers that we have to avoid and rehabilitate those to a better than new condition. We typically line those with a, for lack of a better word, a plastic liner. And that allows actually flows to move through faster based on less friction. And typically we get actually higher flow through those sewers than their current condition right now.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Big Dig Tunnel Project here in Indianapolis. It is a $2 billion project that's going to divert sewer overflow from Indy waterways. It's underway, and it's being led by Citizens Energy. My guests are Laura O'Brien from Citizens Energy, John Tripas, who is the Director of Underground Engineering and Construction, and Nick Maynard, Construction Specialist. If you want to join the conversation, it looks like quite a few of you do, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the large-scale Dig Indy Tunnel Project. This is about diverting sewer overflow from Indy waterways, and it's underway and being led by Citizens Energy. My guests are Laura O'Brien from Citizens Energy, John Tripas, director of underground engineering and construction, and Nick Maynard, construction specialist. If you want to join the conversation, you've got several ways of doing that. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. And I'm going to say right now we've got close to a full phone bank and emails flowing in here. So I'm going to ask everyone so that as many people get a chance to get their questions addressed and all of that, both listeners and guests here and all of that, if we can try to be as concise and tight as possible, because it's clear there's a lot of interest in this subject. We've gotten an email from a listener named Bruce. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Bruce writes, "It's my understanding that by the time rainwater gets to the sewers, it's strongly acidic. What part of the treatment process neutralizes the acid?"
That's a variable question. Depending where we are in the city, there's sometimes near different plants or what people or sometimes the public may spill on the roadways. It's really variable what rainwater or stormwater might pick up before it gets into the sewer system. Most of the time, it's fairly neutral by the time it gets to our treatment plant. Normally, where we deal with this issue is with what's called industrial pretreatment or scenarios for pretreatment. So we have regulations in place that basically indicate parameters of the water, including acidity, that is monitored ahead of time from our unit. If it's outside of the parameters, we work with them to get it inside of the parameters within before it even discharges to our sewer system, and then we issue a permit for that. At our treatment plant, we monitor pH, flows entering into the plant, and as it exits the plant. We do have items, be it in a caustic or an acid or a base, to try to neutralize that should it become a condition or situation. But we haven't experienced anything at either plant that would be significant enough to warrant adding those chemicals.
We are talking about the Dig Indy project here on No Limits. Art, you're on the air.
Yes, my question is on earthquake risk. What kind of assessment do they do on earthquake risk? Is it an insurable risk? Is the city going to have insurance? And so how expensive is it, so that we could get an idea for the average listener what the cost of earthquake insurance would be as well?
Thank you very much for the call and the question, Art. Yeah, that's something people don't realize, that actually in portions of Indiana are right along the New Madrid fault line. So there is some risk of earthquake here.
Yeah, we've absolutely considered earthquakes. And as you mentioned, there is a fault line nearby. The beauty of earthquakes is earthquakes really affect the surface soil. And why that is even when there's, depending on different types, whether they're a thrust or slip and slide type earthquake, whatever happens in the bedrock is quite minimal. And most of where the activity occurs by a process called liquefaction is in the soils above it. So the soils actually begin to regrade, and they cause all that movement on the surface, which leads to the most destruction. This is seen pretty repeatedly in places like California and high tectonic environments. You'll see the same process that we do. A lot of the tunnels and subway tunnels are some of the safest areas in California, just like they are with us. As long as we're not building directly over into a fault line, actually our deep tunnel is probably one of the safest areas in the city should we get some type of tectonic activity.
Gotten an email from a listener named Sam. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Sam writes, "One of the gentlemen said that they remove the chlorine before dumping the water back into the White River. My question is, what exactly do they use to remove the chlorine In a broader question, how can regular citizens remove chlorine from their treated water with filtration?
I'll answer this one again.
Okay.
So in the treatment process, I mean, we do use advanced treatment for disinfection, which is ultraviolet light. And a residual chlorine is added for additional disinfection when it's needed, especially during some of our wet weather flows. What we use is sodium bisulfite. It helps to neutralize and remove the chlorine before it's discharged back into the waterway. So kind of your different question to go with drinking water. Of our drinking water systems, we intentionally add chlorine as a disinfectant as it goes through our distribution system to your home. The intent is the levels of chlorine we add are not harmful. Some people do find maybe that it adds some odor or taste to their water. A lot of times a Brita filter, simple carbon, will help eliminate that excess chlorine, and you would not need a system to remove chlorine from your drinking water. We don't add that level of it to it.
Nick, this sounds like when you think about it, not only is it a complicated, but it's a massive one that involves a lot of people. Just in terms of the construction piece of this, how many people are employed doing this work? I mean, how many people are working at this right now?
I'd say for my project, so I primarily focus on the near surface work, what you'd see at Meridian, Shelby Street closure near Garfield Park, and also Pine and Market Street. I'd say a typical job site near surface, you'd have upwards to 20 to 30 people. Throughout our system for these near surface sites, we probably have a little over 50 of these sites over the next 7-8 years.
Laura, how many, I know Citizens Energy has done some calculation on this. How many jobs do they think that this project is going to generate?
I don't have the exact number, John. Do you?
Yeah, we've
no.
We've done an economic and impact analysis, basically, that what we generate in revenue or what's done in taxes, basically people working on the job. And then we've looked at what it is defined by the federal government as an employable person, which is 12 months of continuous employment. And literally throughout the project period, we will add upwards of 10,000 jobs to the area. That includes some of the contractors on site. And again, remember, we might have 50 people working on our tunnel, but then there's also subcontractors that are involved in the process. And then we have a lot of people that are providing those materials like concrete and steel and other equipment. So you got to imagine it's kind of it builds like a ladder. There's a lot of jobs and equivalent jobs that are generated, as well as adding upwards of $6 billion overall through this concept to the economy. And this is pretty standard way that the federal government looks at employment added, as well as adding value or dollars to the economy.
Gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Jacob. And again, if you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Jacob writes, has Citizens Energy abandoned the STEP project that was started to remove the large amount of residential septic tanks located and failing next to the White River?
So yeah, that's a really good question. So STEP project stands for Septic Tank Elimination Program. And as Indianapolis and Marion County became kind of the consolidated UniGov years ago, a lot of the smaller areas were incorporated, and we inherited as a community about 30,000 septic systems throughout Marion County. And starting through Barrett Law, continuing through what the city and Department of Public Works started through the initial STEP program, and continuing that program at Citizens with some significant changes in 2016, we, during what's called a high priority STEP program removal. And it's a good question because this does tie into our deep tunnel program. We're not mandated under our consent decree to continue with septic tank elimination, but we have voluntarily worked with the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission to continue our STEP program, really on the basis it does improve water quality. Some of the older failing septic systems do add bacteria and high level of nutrients to our waterways, which also impact the overall water quality. So the short answer is we are continuing that program. Currently now we're spending about $6 million per year on communities regulating the high priority program. At the end of the program, we will have removed about half the septic tanks in the city, so about 15,000-16,000 are currently slated for removal, and ultimately identified about 18,000 as, for lack of a better word, the best bang for the buck for as water quality is considered.
We're talking about the Dig Indy tunnel project here in Indianapolis and central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Jill has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jill, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have a question, please, regarding the new sewer drainage system, whether it's going to help with the torrential rains that we get sometimes that flood Washington Street all the way down through the east direction. And I've just seen, like, the folks walking and waiting for buses just get completely soaked. And I just wonder if this new drainage system is going to help with any of that standing water. I know some of it is just from torrential rain, but sometimes just a good kind of, quick heavy rain, and it's building up almost to the whole left side of the east and west directions. So that was my question, if that's going to assist with that at all.
Thanks very much for the call, Jill, and the question. So who would like that one?
I'll take it.
John, okay. They're all looking at you, so.
So as Citizens Energy Group, we work with the city. We acquired the wastewater, basically the sanitary and combined sewer system from the city of Indianapolis, as well as the water system. The city of Indianapolis still owns the stormwater system and helps with runoff that occurs, as well as us in the combined area. So you're referencing Washington Street. We're both at the table. We work really closely with the city on maintaining these sewers and trying to allow as much of that stormwater to enter into the system as possible. And you probably mentioned the key word there, which some of the torrential rains, and not to bring up global climate change, but even with normal storm events, our city, as well as many others, we just design storm sewers and combined sewers are so big, so we try to handle, on average, what's called a 10-year, one-hour storm event. But a lot of the variable storm events we get, they just overload our storm sewer systems. As the rivers and streams get higher in elevation because of that rain, it starts to limit the flow that can even get out to those water bodies. So unfortunately, this will help a little bit because it'll send some of that flow into the tunnel where it would normally be trying to push into a riverway. But there won't be a substantial difference you would notice with this. This is really a water quality focus to get raw sewage out of the rivers as opposed to helping with flood or street flood control.
What kind of event? I mean, is there a possibility that, given that, and again, this show is not about climate change, but, a lot of people talk about the fact that there is a lot more volatility in our weather patterns these days. Is there a worry at all that the capacity of the system still won't be up to the challenge? And what sort of event would it take to overwhelm the capacity of the system?
That's a good question. I have a lot of worries, usually my boss calling me in the middle of the night about some flooding or some other type issue. No, I'm kidding. I think Indianapolis, again, like a lot of cities, it's a very reliable system for the most part. I'd say one of the big disadvantages in the Midwest is it's fairly flat. So you don't get a whole lot of benefits of maybe hills kind of moving some of that runoff to different areas a little quicker. So it tends to stage up a little more on our streets. And a lot of it is really just getting it into the sewer system. There's only so many inlets we could provide with the size of the pipe. So we are evaluating global climate change. That is something we, on our sensitivity analysis, we consider quite a bit on what some of those changes are, how it would impact the system, and then evaluating, again, I mean, how big of a sewer system can we make before it literally turns into an underground river in and of itself? So it's one of those balances of cost where we think we will still get 90% of those storms or more from flooding the streets, but we believe there'll still be several a year that occur that just overwhelm the system.
Tim, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Had commented, I used to work at the Southport Sanitation Plant back in the early 80s when they were building that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really into all the speed of cleaning up the waterways and everything. So I think all you guys are doing a great job.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You know, I know it costs money, and it's a lot of money to do this, but back in the 80s, they predicted this, that we would need to update all of our systems, especially like the grid now, how everything's computerized. You have a computer glitch, everything goes offline. You have to have something that will keep the system going. So I'm from Broderpool originally, so I've actually skied White River and grew up swimming in it. So it's great. You guys are cleaning up the waterways and doing what you can to do it. And my other question was, how do you even apply to get a job there? Because I say I used to
have
a labor union.
That's good. Let me see if I can get an answer for you. I'm going to move it along because we're getting close on time here, Tim. But thank you very much for
I'm
the
living out
question.
In the country now. I'm actually on a septic now that I'm having problems with. So that's another question that I got to find out. I mean, this show's giving me a lot of information.
Well, and I'll tell you what, after we go off the air, we can continue this conversation on Facebook, and I drive everybody to do that. I'm sure my guests will continue
coming. I don't do Facebook or any of that stuff.
Okay, well, we'll see if there's another way we can get you the info. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Tim. So, you know, in terms of hiring, are you still hiring for these projects? And if so, how do people go about doing that?
So a lot of our projects, I mean, Citizens Energy Group, you could always go to our website, citizensenergygroup.com, where we identify employment opportunities. We're an equal opportunity employer, and there's always a lot of opportunities there. I'd say beyond that, with your experience at a wastewater treatment plant, perhaps with an operator's license, we work with a lot of the firms and contractors we work with routinely hire from the union. We do union as well as non-union work on a lot of our different jobs. So there's a lot of different opportunities out there.
And because we are close on time, I'm going to try to synthesize several questions here real quickly. One asks, when will there be an increase in fish in the White River after the tunnel comes online? Another one is, it's not just focused on downtown. Will people on the south side and the north side start seeing benefits in the quality of the water there, and how quickly?
We absolutely believe there will be more fish and more biodiversity in general in the waterways and diversity amongst the fish population. We're evaluating that. We've worked and evaluated some other studies on to the extent that will occur. But we do know it will occur, and again, we think the full benefit will definitely be in 2025. We'll have the full system online. We'll be, again, removing upwards of 6 billion gallons of combined raw sewage. So the impact will occur throughout downtown. And there'll be a lot of positive effects, again, on the south side of the city and beyond.
And I think that'll have to be the last word for now. I would invite you to continue the conversation on Facebook with our listeners if they have further questions. Also, given the level of interest, I'd invite you all to come back and talk some more about this, since it sounds like it's going to be going on for a while. I'd like to thank my guests, Laura O'Brien, John Tripas, and Nick Maynard, for what has been a lively and informative hour. Also like to thank our listeners, as usual, for some great questions. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.